On the program today, the minimum wage, mortgages, and what your smartwatch can tell us about this virus. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday today, the 22nd day of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You know, it's possible that by the end of the week, this economy is going to be halfway to another $1.9 trillion in government relief. The House is set to vote by Friday, maybe Saturday, on the White House plan. The Senate, well, they'll vote later, but the political gears of the American economy are grinding away. Of the many things in this bill, we will cover some of them. And today, it's a provision that would raise the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour. Might make it through, might not, but you cover the bill as written, right? It should be noted here that some states already have or have approved a $15 an hour minimum. So Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer gets us going with this look at what the bill might do on minimum wage and for whom.
Benjamin Yellen is a bartender at the Whiskey Kitchen in downtown Raleigh, North Carolina. He spells his name Y-E-L-L-I-N, by the way, so no relation to Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen. Benjamin Yellen says his hours and income have been cut by about half during the pandemic. Since he relies on tips, Yellen never knows what he'll make each day.
To know that you're going to work and able to at least make that $15 an hour, that would be so extremely helpful.
Yellen only makes $2.13 an hour, plus tips. The latest relief bill, the American Rescue Plan, would gradually raise the federal minimum wage for all workers, including tipped employees, to $15 an hour. Sadeh Gebrselassie is an attorney at the National Employment Law Project. She says the higher minimum wage would especially help people like Yellen, who are now the frontline workers of the pandemic.
The median pay for workers in those jobs, so you know, nursing assistants, home health care aides, grocery store workers, is below $15 an hour.
That's because 60% of the workforce in this country lives in states with minimum wages below $15 an hour. Heidi Shierholz, senior economist at the Economic Policy Institute, says the bump up to $15 would make a big difference for people of color.
Almost a third of Black workers would see a raise with this minimum wage increase. For Hispanic workers, it's almost as high. It's 26%.
And Shierholz says more than half of the people who'd get a raise with a $15 an hour federal minimum wage would be women, many supporting families. I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
For those of you who've been thinking about maybe refinancing your mortgage, and you can't see me now, but I got my hand raised, that sound you hear is the window of sub 3% rates slowly being closed. The average on a 30-year fixed climbed to 3.04% today. That's from Bankrate. It's up from about 2.86% a week ago. Blame, if you are looking to point fingers, all the worries about inflation floating around out there and commensurately higher yields as bond investors demand those yields to compensate. Marketplace's Amy Scott looks at what all that could mean for the housing market.
To be clear, mortgage rates of around 3% are ridiculously low, historically speaking.
If you zoom out, even if they were 3.5, even if they were 3.8, that's still very low.
That's Nicole Ward, a mortgage broker with White Oak Financial in Atlanta. A decade ago, the average on a 30-year fixed was about 5%, and a decade before that, about 7%. Bank rate analyst Greg McBride says mortgage rates are loosely tied to the yield on the 10-year Treasury note, and that's been rising in recent weeks over worries that stronger economic growth, fueled by COVID vaccines and more stimulus from Congress, will lead to inflation.
From a bond investor's perspective, inflation is their worst enemy because it erodes the value of those fixed payments that a bondholder receives over time. So bond investors demand higher yields to compensate for that.
But the Federal Reserve has some sway over mortgage rates, too. Carissa McDonough is fixed income strategist at People's United Advisors. She says the Fed has been buying Treasury and mortgage bonds to help keep rates low and hasn't signaled any plans to pull back.
They recognize that housing has been a significant contributor to economic recovery, and the last thing they want to do is to choke that off.
In the meantime, Delfino Aguilar with Kind Lending says even the slight uptick has some existing homeowners scrambling to refinance.
Borrowers are calling the broker saying, hey, you know, I'm hearing in the news that rates are going up. You know, what can you do for me? Or is it too late?
But while an increase in rates may slow down refis, brokers say it's not enough to dampen demand for new mortgages in a hot housing market. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Should you be looking for a macroeconomic state of the union, other than what you get on this program, of course, tomorrow is your day. Fed Chair Jay Powell will be on Capitol Hill virtually, I'm going to guess here, for his semi-annual update to Congress. We will let you know, of course, what he says. On Wall Street today, more down than up. Mostly we'll have the details when we do the numbers. The new season of our podcast, The Uncertain Hour, is of a theme: how employment in this economy is and has been changing. And one of the defining characteristics of work in America the past couple of decades, at least, has been outsourcing. We hear about it in the context of layoffs or jobs just flat out getting shipped overseas. But why do companies do it? Is there anything beyond just cutting costs and headcounts? Marketplace's Peter Ballin on Rosen looks at how one management theory took on a life of its own.
So a management theory comes from the brain of a management theorist, of course. And Gary Hamel certainly looks like one.
Gray hair and a mustache and I guess a geezer is the technical term.
The technical term, yes. Today, Hamel's a writer and professor at London Business School and has been described as the world's leading expert on business strategy. But back before he was a geezer, in 1990, Hamel set out to solve a problem.
U.S. industry was being pummeled by international competitors. And I was trying to unpack what made them so successful.
U.S. companies were falling behind in consumer electronics and the car industry, these key markets. Japanese companies like Canon, Sony, Honda were all of a sudden dominating. Hamel saw Canon had gotten really good at miniaturizing electronics, making them competitive in calculators, cameras, and printers. Honda was focused on making efficient powertrains for things from cars to lawnmowers. And in an influential 1990 Harvard Business Review paper, Hamel called those kinds of skills
core competencies.
Core competencies. And that, folks, is our management theory. Hamel defined core competencies as skills, technologies, and processes that give companies a competitive advantage and are hard to replicate. He said doubling down on that was key to corporate success. But companies had so many people on payroll, from engineers to janitorial staff, not all fell within a company's core competencies.
I'm not sure that for most organizations I could think of, janitorial services really are going to make much of a contribution to their competitive advantage. So if you can find a company that's willing to provide you janitorial services for less, probably you should do that.
Back after the core competencies article was published, the rise of the internet, combined with new trade policies, led to a major burst of outsourcing. Call centers popped up around the world. In the U.S., armies of subcontracted janitors, cafeteria workers, and warehouse workers emerged. In places like Silicon Valley, between 1990 and 2016, subcontracted jobs grew at three times the rate of all private sector jobs. Companies were taking this idea, finding their core thing, and then outsourcing everything else.
If anybody speaks about it as if it's this sort of evil thing, it really disturbs me.
Debbie Polishook was a group chief executive for Accenture, one of the world's largest providers of outsourced labor. People on Accenture payroll moderate content for Facebook, work in call centers, and serve as consultants to major companies.
The strategic driving force for our clients back in the day was access to lower cost labor.
Basically, find people to do the same jobs for cheaper.
Fast forward to where we are today, we started saying, how can we take these processes that we take on and make them even better?
Polishuk says companies that provide labor thrive when they provide a skill beyond other businesses' core competencies, when they can do something others can't.
This type of work has been happening forever. There's always been advertising agencies, right? And very rarely did a company have an in-house agency.
Some economists say the rise of labor contracting is helping to fuel income inequality. You've got one set of people with full employment, sick days, decent benefits, and then this whole parallel society of people doing contract or temp work with less job security benefits and pay.
Every idea has unintended consequences.
Gary Hamel, the management theorist, says he never meant for his core competence theory to justify outsourcing. In fact, he first used the term when consulting for Carrier, the heating and AC company. They were considering outsourcing manufacturing to a Japanese company.
I wrote a memo. I said, you know, just think of this as a core competence and ask, is this something that you're willing to give up?
Hamel wasn't saying, find out what makes you special and outsource the rest. He was saying, find out what makes you special and never let it go. I'm Peter Balanon-Rosen for Marketplace.
There is, of course, more about how the American workforce has changed on the Uncertain Hour podcast. Subscribe, would you, on your platform of choice. One of the ways that businesses, a lot of businesses anyway, have survived this pandemic is by figuring out a way to profit from it. Not in the pecuniary price gouging sense, but in the innovative what new needs are there out there sense. Car factories retooled to make ventilators. Distilleries cranked out hand sanitizer instead of booze. And wearables companies, makers of smartwatches and rings to count your steps and your workouts, they found a new use for their data, predicting cases of COVID. And as Marketplace's Scott Tong reports, those devices are now the subject of a big set of clinical trials to get a better picture of their medical utility.
Before COVID, researcher Ashley Mason at the University of California, San Francisco, was studying a different condition, hyperthermia, tracking patients with consumer fitness devices called Oura rings. They start at $300, and they're chunky metal bands for fingers with sensors in the middle to monitor temperature and other things. And then came the pandemic. And Mason got thinking.
And I said, gosh, it's really neat that these things measure temperature and that fever seems to be such a prominent symptom in COVID. And what if we could measure this? And we thought, sheesh, why don't we do this? And the company said, hey, we'll provide rings.
Rings for more than 1,000 medical professionals to look for biometric predictors of COVID. Normally, getting a study like this approved and funded takes months. But here,
things happened with unbelievable lightning speed like I have never seen in my life as a researcher. I believe that the conversation where we conceived of this idea was on a Wednesday night. I think that we had a contract by Sunday night.
The study also included tens of thousands of owners of Oura rings. They're more convenient and far less invasive than temperature trackers used in past studies.
I don't really think I could convince people to wear an indwelling rectal probe for a week. I think that'd be pretty difficult, but getting them to wear an Oura ring for a week is a piece of cake.
Her team found that out of 50 people who got COVID, 45 had warning signs from the rings in advance. Now, Mason is running a new ring study to contact participants who show concerning biodata in real time and suggest they get tested. And that's when I said, I want an Oura ring.
And the company was nice to send me one to try. And it measures not just my exercise here in the treadmill, but also my heart rate, my respiratory rate, my temperature. And there's this number called readiness. It's a composite of all the measurements to kind of score my health every morning.
I woke up, my readiness was 68, and I'm like, that's a little weird. My normal, I would say, is like 80 to 92.
That's ring wearer Renee Bells of Las Vegas. Last June, her numbers were way off when she and her husband took a staycation at a local resort. She was tired, but no fever.
I'm walking around a casino, passing through all the temperature checks just fine.
Days later, she and her husband tested positive for COVID. This promise of early detection has some organizations trying wearables on their own. At Oakland University in Michigan, hundreds of students just began wearing what's called the bio button, a digital patch the size of a quarter that tapes to the chest. The hope is to catch any outbreak early, says University Health Science Professor David Stone.
We were thinking of students in residence halls and trying to limit that one case from becoming 50 cases and from having to shut down the campus or shut down a dorm.
The bio button can also do contact tracing.
If you were wearing the button and I was wearing the button and I was positive and you came within Bluetooth range, you know, 15 or 20 feet of me, and stayed there for a half an hour. Your data would know that.
Not all students chose to wear the button, and data privacy is a question wearables makers and researchers have to address. And we don't know how convincing the current study results will be. Stanford genetics professor Michael Snyder is running his own COVID study on people with Apple Watches, Fitbits, and other trackers. He says the potential breakthrough here is not just fighting COVID, but having the medical community take wearables and sensors seriously.
The average human has a total of zero sensors, whereas your car has maybe up to 400 sensors. And that drives me nuts. I think that, you know, people are more important than cars.
He thinks consumer wearables can someday predict other viral infections and bacterial infections, plus heart and lung problems, even diabetes. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Hey, do me a favor. Would you listen to the Marketplace Morning Report tomorrow? I promise it'll be worth your time. Coming up.
I took a snapshot when I was having the fascination and I've sent it around.
I mean, I would too, you know. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 27 points today. Not even worth a mention, really, percentage-wise. 31,521. The NASDAQ down 341 points, 2.4%. Finished at 13,533. Why, you ask? Because stocks go down too. That's why. The S&P 500 gave back 30 points, about 0.7%, 38.76. Airline stocks moved higher today. That 777 incident over the weekend, notwithstanding. United improved 3.4%. Delta Airlines up 4.5%. American Airlines up 9.4%. What you're looking at there is pent-up demand. People banking on vaccines and traveling. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note, as I alluded to in the lead to Amy's story, up to 1.37%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The House, as I said up at the beginning of the program, is set to pass the president's big relief bill, then the Senate, of course, all in the hopes of getting everything lined up before the current relief runs out in the middle of March. Most specifically, an extra $300 a week in federal unemployment benefits. And that, those benefits and the timing thereof, gets us to the macroeconomic policy phrase of the day, automatic stabilizers.
There are two parts to it.
Adriana Kugler teaches economics and public policy at Georgetown.
The automatic part refers to the fact that the policy does not require government authorization for it to be activated, for it to be triggered on or off.
Okay, part two.
The stabilizer part refers to the fact that these policies smooth out economic activity over downturns and booms.
This economy, remember, went from 3.5% unemployment a year ago this month to almost 15% in April a year ago. There has been lots of relief, yes, trillions of dollars, but those programs have been inconsistent at best, political as big dollar amounts do tend to be in Washington, D.C.
We could simply turn them into permanent programs that don't have to be introduced every time we have a recession, but that will trigger on and off automatically.
And that trigger, that switch, is all about economic data. Here's Louise Shaner. She's at Brookings.
You could look at changes in the national unemployment rate.
When the national jobless rate starts to go up, a recession is perhaps in the offing if you read the data, or you could tie assistance to a specific state's unemployment level.
You might want to raise unemployment benefits during that time period.
And then?
When the economy starts to recover,
the unemployment rate goes back down and the assistance
comes off automatically and Congress doesn't have to pass that.
The catch, of course, with automatic stabilizers is that they are automatic, which takes some degree of congressional control and thus power over this economy out of their hands. The
The virus news from the UK today was pretty optimistic. Prime Minister Boris Johnson laid out a four-step reopening plan that starts with schools getting back into session on March 8th and, all other things being equal, unlimited reopening over there on June 21st. That said, though, much like here, the virus has hit the poorest and most underserved the hardest. The East End of London is one of those places that's been hit. Last month, it recorded the UK's highest rates of infection. And as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports, the economic and the emotional scars are going to take a long time to heal.
With COVID death and infection rates updated daily, it's sometimes easy to forget that behind every number, there's a name.
Reginald Phillips, Mahung Ngoyen, Van Tor Vu.
At this memorial service in the East End, a funeral home remembered all those they buried or cremated last year. Due to COVID, it was more than double the usual number, a grim, unprecedented task for mortician John Harris and his staff.
I mean, everyone is sort of working much longer hours. Some are putting in 15, 16 hours a day. Some are working right the way through the night with call-outs.
Harris says the family-owned firm has never before had to deal with the current level of mortality. Not even, his father has told him, during the Blitz in the Second World War when German bombers hammered the East End.
Dad, reflecting now, thinks that this pandemic was even worse than what he experienced, if you take away the bombs, obviously.
In early January, there were 5,000 new infections a week in the East End borough of Newham, one of the highest rates in the country. Jason Strelitz, the borough's director of public health, says in this densely populated, low-income neighbourhood, there's been little scope for self-isolation.
We have a lot of people who work out in the community, either in frontline health and social care roles, in retail jobs, in transport, security, the kind of jobs that you just can't do from home.
Migrants from scores of different countries have settled here. You can see that in Queen's Market. Halal butchers trade side by side with Indian jewellers and African fruit and vegetable sellers. It's a wonderful mix. But Zoe Malik, the daughter of Pakistani parents, who was born and brought up in Newham, says aspects of South Asian family life in particular have proved challenging in the time of COVID.
A lot of people live with their grandparents, their parents, their siblings, their sister-in-laws perhaps, their nephews, their nieces. Because of that, it can easily spread and then they will easily be affected.
Zoe and all her family caught the virus during the first wave. They all survived, but this convinced her to join a local council-run program called COVID Champions to combat pandemic misunderstandings and denial.
I need to do something about this. I need to spread a word and make everyone aware that this is a real thing.
Local mosques have been pressed into service to refute rumours that the COVID vaccines contain alcohol and animal products and are therefore haram or prohibited. Another COVID champion, 75-year-old Nigerian-born Olanrewaju Odunlami, has been countering other vaccine myths among some of his neighbours.
They believe, from what they've heard from their friends, that it's a dangerous drug that is to depopulate the black community.
Historic scandals about the unethical use of black people in medical research, combined with distrust for the British authorities, have led to a widespread aversion to the vaccine among minority ethnic groups across Britain. In Newham, Odunlami has been doing his bit to change that.
I took a snapshot when I was having the vaccination and I've sent it round to all our group.
A modern version of the Blitz spirit, perhaps, which helped the Londoners of 80 years ago survive the bombing. But as then, the economic damage caused by the current disaster seems likely to linger. One East End borough expects the pre-pandemic number of its families on welfare to triple to 50,000 by the spring. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which, honestly, your guess is as good as Wall Street's. We're going to get an update on fourth quarter gross domestic product growth this week. Should be give or take 4%. And remember, that's annualized.
But that's not my point. We've done annualized a bunch on this program. My point is the guessing game around first quarter 2021 economic growth, which is, of course, what we are in the middle of right now. Here are some of the entries. The Atlanta Fed says it's going to be 9.5%. Goldman Sachs, 6%. JP Morgan, 5%. Or, and for the second time in this broadcast, I'm going to pull out this little trope. You can't see me, but I'm doing that shrugging thing. Oh boy, a little tight today. No time for credits. I'm Kai Brisdahl. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.